All right, I would like to thank everybody for coming. And John and I love these conversations. This will also be recorded. So if you go to the Abundant Community website, I don't know if Chris mentioned that, you can get a copy of it. John, you want to introduce Tom a little bit and kind of get us going?
Sure. Well, it's wonderful that everybody who's joined us today can share the wisdom that Tom has. I know of no one who has a more diverse and interesting background in terms of his vocations. He started out as a Linsky-style organizer, as I did at the beginning, and organized in several cities, and then organized farmers in the state of Wisconsin, looking at how do you organize people in rural communities. Then he went on and became what I would call a special assistant to at least two mayors in the city of Madison. And as you all know, when they compare cities and, on these rating scales, Madison always comes out first or second. That's because Tom was there. And then he moved to learn something about the corporate world and worked with a major corporation that is involved in a hospital construction field. Went from there to the University of Wisconsin, where he worked on a faculty looking at how technology could be assisting local communities. From there, he went to work for a couple of years with the teachers union, WEAC, in Wisconsin. And now he is forming a wonderful statewide organization in an era of polarization to see what we can agree on across lines for of common values, especially in terms of families and children. So we're really lucky to have you, Tom. Welcome. Glad you're here. And to frame what we're talking about today, I think that there's something that I think of as a neighborhood, and then there's something I think of as an institution. A neighborhood is the residents and the clubs and groups they form, and an institution is an organization that is powered by money and provides goods and services. Now, those are two very different forms of getting things done, and they are able to perform very different functions. And if we're going to have an effective society, they are going to both have to fulfill their functions. And yet they're not very much alike. They're like, I was thinking, they're sort of like an automobile and a computer. Both are very useful, but they do different things and they have different forms. And so today, what I think we want to explore is how do these two forms perform their functions together in such a way that a neighborhood or a community is increased in its well-being and not necessarily just a place where people consume whatever the institutions provide. So in this institution neighborhood function, the two ways these forms function, I have heard the development of something called gappers, people who work in the gap. So can you tell us about what you and a group that you have put together who are thinking about this question of gappers? Where do we start? What is a gapper? What do they do? What is their purpose?
Well, thank you, John, and thank you, Peter, for inviting me. And also, I know on this call are other persons who do this kind of work or have experienced this particular kind of location in their life between institutions and community. And hopefully they will chime in as we go and share experience and story and questions that will be relevant to this. I think, John, if I can pick up on it, what you said is, you know, we've created two kind of symbols to describe the two large tools that we've created as human beings to get things done. One is a triangle representing systems or institutions, when we got to do a lot of the same thing, and I don't take that lightly. When we need our snowplow in Madison or we need an airplane to get up in the air, we need institutions who have protocols and procedures and policies to make that happen. As a past president of the American Society for Quality with about 100,000 members, I know the value of having standardization for a lot of the things that we take for granted in our lives. On the other hand, we also created a tool called Community, which was, in the beginning, the original form that we oftentimes forget, and it also gets eclipsed by institutions, but is the place in which relationships and our basic democracy is seated. And in between those two, that kind of in-between place we call working in the gap. And hopefully, on this call, we're trying to find out or learn from people who traverse that piece of territory between the triangle and the circle in their daily lives, so whether they're community police officers or public health nurses or people who work at libraries, but know that community is more than the physical structure of the building. Work for community foundations who try and make sure that they strengthen community development by what they do. Church leaders, so those are the kind of things that I think are important, that we not think either or, but we think both. And the possibility of how both institutions and community work together to better, make a better democracy.
Tom, can you comment a little bit on the fact that you have an asset base? Isn't that what makes that trip between institutions and neighborhoods a little bit tricky at times, the asset versus efficiency base?
Well, I think that's a really important point, Peter, and what separates what we're doing from other approaches. And that is that when we think about our traditional service model, having worked for city government for 15 years, oftentimes people's perspective becomes after a while that the job of a city is to deliver services, and if you don't deliver it, then, you know, we get angry about it and that we're spectators as citizens. I often call it a vending machine kind of perspective of the world in which, you know, there's a standard by which you put in your money, you pull a lever, and then, you know, whatever it is you saw comes out the bottom. And when you get that kind of behavior habit in place, you create a dependency. And what we're seeking to do is to appreciate the fact that everybody has gifts in community, everybody has capacities, and to create an environment in which there's a healthy tension between the institutional life and the community. And that I think an effective democracy requires people working in the gap who are willing to take the risks, have the imagination to traverse that gap, and try and make both better.
Thank you. Go ahead,
Tom. When somebody has this kind of gapping position, may have all kinds of names, but they are going to have to meet the standards in some way of the institution, which has a lot of rules and structures, and at the same time relate to informal gatherings and groups and associations in the local community. How do you negotiate that space? What have you learned about the kinds of person who is good at it? What are the skills that they bring to the process of bringing some kind of mutuality between these two very different institutions?
Yeah, it's a important question, and I oftentimes, when I do workshops on this stuff, I talk about the difference between a cafeteria and a potluck. All of us have experienced both of those. They're very different. They both have a similar mission of making sure, you know, you're fed, but one environment is very different than the other in terms of the imagination and creativity and value of story that a potluck would encourage versus an institution which is more transactional, predictable, and orderly. But both are important. And the same is true of an orchestra and a jazz band. So I think they take a special kind of person to do this kind of work. I would say that they're, by number one, by nature, they are connected people. They tend to understand the value of trusted relationships, not just transactional. Or when I work with the police officers, they were the ones who actually educated first, regulated only if you must, as our model, as opposed to just the facts, ma'am. They tend to be more risk takers. They have a bit of an edge to them. They question the institution while at the same time making sure that those things required by the institution get done. And they have to have an imagination, because if you're going to work in the gap between institutions and community, you've got to be very creative in that gap in order to figure out how can you do that in a way that best serves the co-production of the gifts of individuals or communities while at the same time taking care of the needs of the institution. And the final thing I just would say is they have to be politically astute, because they have to keep an eye on both of those and have a sense of humor, because without the humor, you can't imagine and be willing to work in that kind of ambiguity.
When you think about the institutions you've worked with or done training, what would you think are the most important changes that institutions have made who have been effective in dealing with local communities as co-producers? What usually is the baseline that they have to meet in order to be effective in that relationship?
Yeah, my sense is that this is becoming more and more relevant all the time, because I think the demands, the complexity in which we're living today, the demand for service keeps growing under our current paradigm. The demand for more complex delivery systems continue to grow at a time when resources available continue to moderate. And when I go around the country and talk to people, that kind of paradigm of a kind of a scarcity view of the world tends to prevail. And there's a lot of concern out there these days that we cannot continue to, you know, today in Wisconsin, we got 72 referendums going on to try and increase improvements of our schools. Well, I get that. I understand why that's important, but the asset that we're not tapping into in community is beyond just the delivery of financial aid in order to create a better vending machine, but also realizing that we got people in community who have gifts and talents of what we call the head, the heart, and the hands that are never even asked to be part of the process of engaging in a more constructive way as citizens, not just consumers of service. So I think those of us who work in that gap or are willing to both think about it and do it are experimenting with how we deal with that tension and how we make that happen. And I'll tell one very quick story and then stop. In Madison, one of the things we did was set up neighborhood resource teams so that about 6 weeks, refuse pickers, public health nurses, police officers, other kind of libraries in the neighborhoods, et cetera, sit down with the leaders of community to talk about how the triangle and how the circle work together as co-producers of a better community. And we always start with the three questions, John, that you have always framed and I think are so powerful. What can you do for yourself right here in this neighborhood? What do you need a little help with that we can help by providing a small grant or something to support you and what you want to initiate as citizens living here in a neighborhood or a community? And then thirdly, what do you need the city to do? Because that is our public responsibility to you. So that's kind of my framing of what of your question, John.
It's great, which says in a sense that if you start with the community and end with the institution, you're probably likely to get it right. But when we get it wrong is we try to get institutions to do everything, and they can't do everything, and that leaves out the functions that only communities can do. So it's helping each side, I think, to recognize that each has unique functions and that they can support each other in achieving that end of a better neighborhood by recognizing that they both have a role.
Yes, and moving from a mentality of kind of clienthood to citizenship.
Good. Peter, thoughts?
Every system, every school, every social service, every government believes in citizen engagement, civic engagement. Some of them have people whose job that is. What aren't in that willingness? What aren't systems doing that would really engage citizens in the way that you're thinking and we're thinking?
Well, I think I and others on this call who are on our team can share their own perspective on that. But from, you know, being in this stuff right now, doing this stuff, what I see a lot of organizations doing is, you know, we know our people in our community. We do surveys of their needs. We do community conversations. We do town meetings. But they tend to be primarily driven top-down, not bottom-up. They tend to be from the outside in, right? They tend not to be focused on the assets that people have, but what are your needs and deficiencies, and they start with that rather than that being part but not the primary emphasis when they should be thinking about their gifts. And they tend to be led by professionals rather than citizens themselves designing what's appropriate for that community. So those are the kind of principles that we've talked about with ABCD that are so critical, Peter, to a transformation of this kind of activity.
It takes it's a kind of a nuanced understanding, you know, to say hold a town meeting, that makes, well, let's hold a town meeting, but then the structure of the meeting itself is what's decisive. There's one other term you used I think is very powerful, which is co-production. Could you explain what you mean, you or John?
No.
I have a notion of co-production because it's such a powerful concept.
John, you want to take a kick or you want
no,
me
you
to?
No, you go. Go ahead.
Yeah.
Good,
so,
Tom. You're the ones getting paid for this.
Well, I want to give credit to my colleague, Dan Duncan, who I believe is on this. And Dan, I give him credit because that's where I feel this idea came from. But it's that balancing between the triangle and the circle. It's the fact that we actually engage the person or persons in a community in getting their voice to the table in an authentic way to help design the future they want to create as opposed to what we as an institution tend to standardize and think one size fits all. Because each of us have our own story, our own experience, our own gifts that makes us very unique. And when we do co-production, then I feel like I am actually in the conversation as a partner, as opposed to someone that someone else is defining for me what they think I want.
Pete, I wonder if this would be a good time to open up the lines and hear from everybody who's
question?
Here.
Okay, go ahead. I interrupted you, John. So shall we open up the lines? That's a good idea.
Yeah.
So, Chris, maybe you could invite people and tell them how to.
Certainly. Here we go. I'm going to welcome somebody from South Texas here.
Now, you said, but tell them the methodology again, because some people may have come in after you explained that.
Okay.
How do people ask a question, Chris?
Okay, hold on just a minute. For all of you here listening, just again, in order to, if you called in to ask a question, press 8 on your phone. You'll be put in a queue, and we'll take questions in the order in which they come in again. So we're going to open this up now.
Okay, it's star 8, isn't it?
Yep.
Yeah, I think
I believe so.
Yeah.
Okay. Thank you.
Yes, this is
all right, let's take a question.
I'd also like some of the co-producers of the work we're doing on the gap work who are on this call to share perspectives. I think that's a nice transition. So if any of you are there, Dan or Deb or Jeff or any of the others, Bruce, please chime in and share your perspectives.
Okay, we do have a call here.
This is Dan.
Hello. Hello from South Texas. Welcome. You have a question or a comment, and please give us your name.
Hi, this is Dan Duncan.
Hi, Dan.
And one of the conspirators with Tom. So, Tom, you're doing a great job explaining. I just posted on the blog a little bit because I think you really made a very important point, and Peter did as well, that often institutions view community engagement meaning at least we ask people what they need and how they would like it delivered, but it still drives institutional action. It may be better institutional action, but it doesn't engage people as co-producers. So I think for me the key role is really for gappers is how do we ask the first question, which is what can you contribute for both your own and your community's well-being, and then our role of gappers and institutions becomes to help remove barriers so people can share their gifts and become part of the solution rather than recipients of service.
That's great, Dan. Thank you. I have a question in my mind, Dan. Maybe you and Tom can respond to it. And that is, you know, in institutions, we know who the leadership is. How do you think about who are the leaders in neighborhoods? Who are the leaders in communities? Because a lot of times we gather, you know, association, executives, association leaders. But I always wonder, well, how do you really get a good cross-section? Could you talk a little bit about getting the right community leaders at the table or citizens at the table? Maybe calling them leaders isn't the right thing to call them.
Dan, you want to take a kick at that or should I? Can you hear me?
Yes, Tom. Am I still on?
Yes, you are. Go ahead, Dan.
Okay. So you know, I think we have to spend more time having conversations in the community because it's not obvious. But Tom, do you want to add something to that?
Well, I would, as a community organizer, you know, you tend to find there's usually an association with some formal leadership, and I think most of the people on the call appreciate those folk. But oftentimes they may not be the connected leaders. They may actually be the ones that the institutions recognize because they're in some kind of a booklet that the community development department puts out. But the real leader may be somebody that is informal but has a lot of connections in the neighborhood who've taken care of other people's kids or done something to actually create some local action in which they got people together. And if you go around and actually do conversations with people in that community, you're going to find out by, you know, people saying, well, you got to talk to so-and-so, who the real leaders are as opposed to those that may be on the formal documents down at City Hall.
And Tom, if I could add, I think another key point is the association life in the neighborhood. One of the things I found helpful is to go to the associations, whether that's churches or places of faith or other groups where people come together and really ask who are the most active members in the association, because they are often the people with the most connections, as you've highlighted, the most relationships that are really viewed as leaders in the community.
That's great. Great. Now, I'm wondering if there's other people lined up?
No, there aren't.
Okay.
Some interesting chat comments. One from Paul Signorelli, I guess, about libraries. I didn't know if you wanted to address.
Well, we can. Paul said, grateful to hear the repeated mentions of important roles libraries play in all of this. So we can kind of underlie that. Another comment was, we need to help schools trust their community. Community gets frustrated when they try to engage and are not brought into schools in a meaningful way. And again, we encourage you to call in *8 and make a comment, ask a question. So Deb, how do I line up to make a comment? Click *8. Thoughts or questions you have, John, while we're kind of waiting for people to call in? I don't see any other questions.
One more just popped up.
Okay.
Let me unmute this. Welcome. You have a question for today. If you'd give us your name, please.
Yeah. Hi, this is Jeff Yost in Nebraska. Good afternoon, everybody.
Hi, Jeff.
Hi, Jeff. Yeah. Hi, Jeff.
One of the important things that John and Tom and others have helped those of us at the Nebraska Community Foundation discern the last few years is that the Nebraska Community Foundation is an institution. It's a statewide institution. But throughout the state, we have a few hundred affiliated funds, and of those, over 100 of those are what we call community-based affiliated funds. And what we've really discerned from that is that community-based affiliated funds are, in fact, voluntary associations supported by the Nebraska Community Foundation as an institution. So many of our affiliated fund coordinators that work for the Nebraska Community Foundation but do training and education and technical assistance with these community-based affiliated funds, you know, they're really folks working in the gap. And Tom was just here a couple weeks ago, and Tom and John have spent some time here, and I just wondered if Tom and John, maybe you wanted to talk about that as sort of one particular example in terms of just kind of, again, helping to illuminate the gap work. And part of what we're always trying to focus on through the Nebraska Community Foundation is, at the end of the day, mission fulfillment here isn't necessarily institutional sustainability. It's communities being successful at what they're, you know, what they've envisioned and what they've planned. And if that happens, then all of us are going to do just fine. I can share that, and then if the two of you want to comment on that, that's fine. And if you want to move on to something else, that's fine as well.
Jeff, let me turn the question back to you, because it seems to me you're one of the great examples of an institutional leader who has working with you people who are gappers. And yet I know from looking at what's happening in these small towns that you have a set of principles as the institutional leader that guide you so that you are, in fact, stimulating and supporting, not commanding and directing. Can you give us your hear you, the institutional voice? Tell us what principles guide you so that you don't become the emperor, but you become the facilitator.
Okay. I'll be happy to take a shot at least a couple of those, John. I think the first and probably the guiding principle of all of this is that the only people that can build and sustain a community are the people that live and work there. So any of us that don't live and work there, we need to come in with a significant amount of humility and first first you listen to understand, then you provide counsel or help facilitate a conversation or really help people to discern what they want. The second is money isn't going to solve all of these problems. Communities are built by people, and money is a tool and an important tool to do facilities and programs and so forth. But money in and of itself isn't an outcome. It's a tool within the community building process. The third is institutionally, every day we're interested in pushing power out the door. So the Nebraska Community Foundation itself isn't a grant maker. All of our affiliated funds are the grant makers within this system, with the idea that if the Nebraska Community Foundation itself was a grant maker, it's possible that community leaders wouldn't be as honest and transparent with us about either their opportunities or their challenges. And the more truthful people can be with us, the better off we're going to be in trying to help them navigate their circumstances and take advantage of a potential opportunity. And the fourth that I'll put out there is, you know, the theory that that you and Jody and others have framed over time, and it's a theory of abundance. And we've used that theory of abundance time and time again to help people both quantitatively and qualitatively understand all of the indigenous assets in their place and what are the different ways that we might be able to activate those assets for the benefit of those people.
That's a great set of principles. I think it was the third. You used the phrase pushing power out the door. Now, that strikes me as one of the most difficult ideas one can imagine for an institutional leader to embody. And let me ask you, what's the self-interest of the head of a police department or the head of a corporation or the head of a hospital to push some power out the door? Why would anybody do that?
Well, maybe I'll do this, John. Maybe I'll turn it back to Tom and ask Tom to talk about
yeah, okay.
Within the context of the police department in Madison. I think that's to me it's all mission fulfillment, so I'll let Tom respond to that too.
And yeah. Gentlemen, when you're ready, there is somebody, I believe, from West Washington State that does want to comment when they're able.
Thanks, Chris.
Tom, why don't you respond, and then we'll move on.
Yeah, thanks. So there are about three quick things. One is I think the metaphor of whether we're trying to create organizations that have power over and the mindset of power over paradigm versus power with, right, more of a collaborative kind of approach, which is sustainable long-term versus a power over kind of mindset is what I'm hearing Jeff talk about. Secondly, I can vouch for the fact from being on the ground with him recently that he and his staff really work hard at this, that they really create a healthy tension all the time between how do we push the power out and what do we have to do, because that is our responsibility as the Nebraska Community Foundation. But the fact is they consciously and intentionally spend time thinking about that so that it's always part of the way in which they operate as an organization. So, and then thirdly, the Madison Police, I think, are a good example that Jeff is referring to. We made the very conscious decision to shift from a culture of law enforcement to one of peacekeeping as a major shift in the way we do business here. And then all the things relevant to that in terms of how we deploy our officers. So we got a lot of them out of their cars, walking in the neighborhoods, doing more community development work as officers. And always thinking about we educate first, regulate only if we must, and have that healthy tension about the culture in which we've created. And that has operated now for 20-some years. And the result of that, we've created leaders both within the department and in communities that hold that kind of culture sacred here, that we have primarily a peacekeeping force rather than a traditional law enforcement agency.
And Tom, if anything ever brought that home to me, I remember years ago, you're taking me to meet with the police chief. We walked in, he had a flag beside his desk and two pictures. One was Gandhi and the other was Martin Luther King. And if that doesn't signify a culture change, I don't know what does. We have somebody out in Washington State wants to talk.
Good morning.
State.
Can you hear me?
Good morning.
Hello. Hi, Tom. This is Bruce.
Hey, Bruce.
Hey, I'm wondering if you'd talk a little bit about something I've been thinking about. I was on a phone call this morning with a group of people and for an hour long and in a large metropolitan area, and they're going to launch into some community organizing and some asset-based stuff, and they kept going back to the idea of population-level results, and it seemed like the more they wanted to talk about that, the more they talked about engaging other large systems in change with them. And it seems like one of the foundational benefits of this gapper idea is it tends to keep things local. It brings the scale back to a level that an ordinary citizen can get their brain and their heart around it. So you've had a lot of experience working in the gap between institutions that want large-scale change and citizens just trying to make their way on a daily basis and improve their lives and the lives of people around them. So I'm wondering if you can talk about that, how the gapper could help with that tension between large system change and local change.
Well, Bruce, make sure you jump in because I'm curious what you did on that call to be helpful with that kind of tension that has to. What's going through my head is, and I think this just affirms what most of you know in our work, which is, are the critical players from the bottom up, inside out, at the table, having voice in the actual development of the outcomes that they seek as co-producers? That, to me, would be critical, because what tends to happen is these things get into rarefied air where kind of experts or professionals or persons who are in roles of authority within institutions define the outcomes that they want for a community. I had it happen this week where someone says, you know, we have all the relationships here in this community, Tom. But you know those are not deep. They are not addressing the people who, they do not know the story of the marginalized. They are not engaging them in what kind of vision or outcome they are seeking, but what they feel institutionally would be the proper product that they are seeking. So that's kind of my reaction, Bruce. And I know that those of us who work in the gap have to be agitators and provocateurs who bring some agitational questions to that conversation about who really are the critical stakeholders, what kind of outcome are we seeking to develop as a result of this, or Peter Block's question, are we trying to hold people accountable, or are we seeking communities where people are accountable because they are intrinsically engaged? I think all of that is the kind of tension we need to create, and that takes some courage as we live and work in the gap.
You know, I would reflect on this, my own belief, this is Peter, that the wish for quick results on a large scale is the resistance against transformation. And so it is the resistance. It's not how do you do it, or do you do it one step at a time. It's a question that if you answer it, means tomorrow will be just like yesterday.
Yeah.
And it's just that, you know, I am interested, Bruce, give us your last name. And then what did you do? What did you say on this conversation this morning? That's a great question.
Well, I Bruce Anderson. I just kept focusing on what to me are the three questions that are telltale about whether or not it's an institutional endeavor or a local endeavor and a local level, and it's who gets to decide the results and who gets to decide the strategy and who gets to make decisions along the way. And those are the kind of the levers for me that determine whether it's moving towards an ABCD model or moving towards a traditional institutional model.
So you can, I think that's the way to be a provocateur, is to keep asking questions about those three things in a gentle way and let people come to their own awarenesses about how that's really working. Because I think a lot of it's blind. A lot of people are, you know, we're so indoctrinated in the usual way of doing things that we actually don't catch ourselves and until we get asked questions.
Thank you.
Bruce, another thought. This is John. The work that we did to develop ABCD, Jody and I and the team back at that time, was always to go to a local place, a small place, and talk to people there about the place and what they had done to make things better. Now, I think that the demand for of large-scale institutions for outcomes that they want is a way to ensure that we won't get change, because change happens finally, locally, and it happens in different ways, can't be standardized. And when you even think about the place, I think just critical is scale, because scale determines the thickness of the possible relationships. If I have six people in the room, the possibilities of the strength of those relationships is different than if I have 100. And we saw over and over again that the effort of institutions to take what had been done by people and their associations locally and scale them up or roll them out, right, was the sure sign that what had happened at the neighborhood that was built from and by the capacity of local people would not happen. You can't roll this stuff out. And it may itself grow. There's a movement growing in Edmonton, Canada, at the block level in terms of people contributing their gifts. But what's really neat is it grows by people in the next neighborhood or the next block hearing about it. So it's one thing to scale something out, but what really, if you want to have anything at all happen that's larger than the neighborhood, it's the proliferation that is natural. So I agree. You really have to resist the very definitions of what success are that institutions who want to scale things are going to press on you.
Right. I think that's one of the things we really have to be on guard for is large institutions talking about change and them wanting to replicate things, even at a small scale. And it just sucks all the ingenuity out of people and local places to try and do that. So I agree with you. Thanks for that, John.
Yeah
thank
you.
Tom, I would just add to that, the word I heard was natural, and the difference between natural and artificial. And institutions tend to create artificial, transactional kind of responses that they can open up the binder and you can go through the process map of how to do it. But, you know, we usually don't have process maps on our refrigerator for our families. And so when we do that, we destroy the very kind of natural co-producing ability that dialogue and relationships require. And it speaks also to the short-term thinking, wanting that by January 1, X will have happened and we'll hit a quota. And, nature does not operate that way. And it's not sustainable. It's not sustainable long-term. And that's the paradigm we're on. And I think we're going to be in deeper and deeper trouble as long as we do not really get more and more people working in the gap between that traditional institutional way of viewing the world and the community as co-producers in a healthy way.
Now, there is a chat question. It says, but there are efforts that are worthy of growth and can be valuable to others. So how can gappers encourage, facilitate, et cetera, growth, scaling and proliferation.
Deb has a comment, I believe, or a question. Deb, you have a question? Go ahead.
Hi there. This is Deb Vishnevsky. Can you hear me okay?
Yep.
Yes.
Great. Great. I'm just really enjoying this conversation with you all. As you all know, I'm very interested in the role of GIFers. And I've been working quite a bit over the past couple of years with groups of GAPers themselves and talking with them about what they feel, what they like about being GAPers and where they feel challenged. And I think that the challenges of being a GAPer is something that we haven't really talked much about yet. You know, the individuals that I've had the pleasure of working with, many of them embrace the role of GAPer. Some feel like it wasn't what the job was when they signed on to it, but that their institution was trying to change the way they were doing things. You know, these are individuals who work for, you know, a social service agency. But the GAPers, you know, the things that I heard about them and the challenges, you know, tend to be things like the institutions that they work for or that fund the institution that they work for. You know, really there's that issue around the mission or mandate of that institution and how can they think about their work differently when they still need to meet all the requirements of their mission or mandate. And on the flip side, you know, they're working with people in the community who I describe as being really trained to defer to institutions. You know, many of these individuals and their families are people who have, you know, felt over their lifetime that, you know, they have to, you know, the institution are the deciders. You know, they're the ones who are the ones in control and who set the parameters. And so I think some of the GAPers that I've worked with have really faced challenges sort of by trying to juggle both sides of that equation.
Mm-hmm. So, Deb, how do you try and help them when they're in that kind of tension between the institution and the community?
Yeah.
Well, I'm sort of style, if you will, is I think maybe Bruce mentioned this earlier. I'm a great believer in asking questions. I am not, as a person who is working with those folks, I am not the expert on what they do or what they experience or what that community is like or what that community experience is. But I feel like I often have a role in asking the questions about, well, why do we do things that way? And why is, you know, is that something that really is part of your mandate or is that something that has evolved over time as a procedure of convenience, for example, you know? So really being the person who tries to help the GAPers be able to ask those questions as well, because I think one thing that's really helped them is, first of all, realizing that they are GAPers. It gives sort of a legitimacy to the tension that they feel around that role, and then giving them the opportunities to talk about what are those challenges and what, you know, what are the benefits of being in that role as well.
Thanks, Deb. I just thought of, this is Tom again, I just thought of one other thing that's really critical to that kind of culture that we're trying to envision and have had some success with, which is I think today I'm seeing more and more fear being driven in a scarcity model as resources, people are told resources are more and more limited. And so fear mutes people's willingness to step out into the gap and do the kind of creative, courageous kind of acts that's required to take the risks to move into that territory.
Mm-hmm.
So I think the work that Jeff Yost and Bruce and other people are doing become more and more important, not by pushing people out there, by asking good questions, though, that help people think through how to best serve in that role in the gap.
Mm-hmm.
I think also it helps if a GAPer can imagine that what's ahead as a result of the new relationships between the institution and the neighborhood is not a set of programs, but a culture.
Mm-hmm.
in which people understand from the neighborhood that we have responsibilities and functions, and people from the institution understand exactly the same thing, and that both of us will get what we want done if we take on that we can do and share with each other. And I think that can become a culture. That's just a way of thinking that can grow throughout a neighborhood and throughout an institution, and you can learn it from how we come to be co-producers. So a gapper, I think, in a way, might be a person who has a vision of a culture but understands the kind of questions and initiatives that build a culture rather than a program.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Again, I think that's where those three questions come into play. I found that to be a very helpful tool for gappers to be able to use while trying to navigate the gap, and trying to help people think about how they can be co-producers, you know, of their own personal lives and of their community lives.
You mean the questions of what can we do for ourselves?
Yes.
What can we do with a little help?
Yeah.
What do we need others to do?
Mm-hmm.
But starting.
People, yeah, starting with what can we do for ourselves. I have found that in some of the simplest situations when I have used those questions, people, it's like these light bulbs go off.
Yeah.
Because it suddenly gives people, helps people to realize that, yes, they do have the power to make decisions about their lives and, you know, lives and about their communities. It's like suddenly they're given permission to do that when, in fact, they had been, again, you know, I go back to this idea of being trained to defer to institutions. You know, I always joke, mm-hmm. you know, we're from the government and we're here to help. But, you know, people think, you know, back to that vending machine idea, they think that that's what they have to do. And they're very afraid. I think Tom's comment about fear being a factor is very pertinent.
Yeah.
You know, the completion of that conversation is we're from the government, we're here to help. And then the other side says, and we're glad to see you.
Yeah, exactly.
You know, and so both of those conversations are a distraction in a way.
Mm-hmm.
Now, I do have anything more you want to say? Deb? Because there's a
no,
question
that's great.
In the chat.
Thank you very much.
This is Beth Strand. I'm reading this. Do you think the millennials who will be more easily adapted to be gappers? Anybody have a thought about that? Or everybody's hoping that
this
the
is
most
Tom and
generation...
I. You know, I don't know the answer to that. All I know is, you know, I don't think it can be. You know, we always talk about not labeling, not boxing up groups, and that's the way I view the world. I take it individual by individual, story by story.
Yeah. So we have about a couple minutes left. Anybody else in line, Chris?
I'm looking now. No, nobody's in line. I'm looking at the chat. I don't see anyone that wants to chime in at this point, Peter.
Okay, Peter, can I share a quick story before we close?
Please do. We need a benediction. Go right ahead.
That's a good way to put it. Well, so in southwest Wisconsin, where I've been spending a good chunk of time experimenting with this work, we've put together a network of local people who are what can we do for ourselves grounded. I mean, they really are. And to kind of cut to the chase, these people are looking at how do we keep our young people in southwest Wisconsin. And many of those are the ones who are not going to go to college, but right away when they go into their high school guidance counselor, the guidance counselor says, well, where are you going to go to college? And right away, if they say I'm not, they're a failure. So we're looking at how we can bring, we now have 6 school districts, 15 large businesses in that region, and about 20, 30 major civic organizations working together from the bottom up, inside out, around how we're going to wrap around the young people who are going to be staying at home and those we want to have come home and support them in a way that they can be successful. And that clearly is an example of what we're talking about here. And we're constantly examining our work. against, you know, our government now has heard about us and want to come in and give money to us in order to make sure we get sucked into the orbit of the triangle statewide. And we're saying, no, we're going to build a co-op locally between each of us, putting in a little bit of money from each entity, and we're going to build it bottom up. So, you know, that's the kind of stuff that imagination can create when good people get together with that kind of way of thinking.
And I'll bet, Tom, that if it's working well, it will grow into a culture in that area.
Exactly. That's
in which the assumption will be, our way is every kind of work is valuable, and you don't have to go to college to be a valuable person.
Right.
And that's in the culture, then everybody will be able to do their part. They'll understand who they are.
And I think, Tom, the end of your story is very powerful, because I think the institutional form of a gift-based culture is the cooperative. And there's an enormous cooperative movement and conversation going on in this country. And,
yeah.
And what the cooperative does structurally is it takes a institution or a function or a business and moves it from the private space to the common space. And I just want to say that. So we're near the end now. Any final comments, John or Tom? The story was wonderful, but you want to say?
Been a great discussion.
Yeah.
Thank you for the opportunity.
Yeah, I'll go ahead and close up. Thanks, Tom, and everyone who participated. Join us next time, June 2nd, or visit our website at www.abundantcommunity.com to stay in touch with us. Unless there's anything else, Peter, I'll say that we're about to close, and thanks to everyone.
No, just to tell your friends that if you like this conversation, you can get a recording of it on the abundantcommunity.com website. Thank you, Chris. Great job.
Great. Thanks.
Thank you.
Bye, all.
Thank you.
Bye all.
Thanks, Tom.